Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're watching a special edition of The Listening Post. This week, we're veering out of the mainstream and looking at journalism that broke the rules, pushed boundaries, and in some cases, redefined them. We're going to explore the work and the legacies of three such innovators, Tom Wolfe, Hassan Kanafani, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, an American, a Palestinian, and a Colombian, all of whom started out as journalists, but went on to straddle the worlds of media, literature, politics, and activism. Their work spawned new genres of reporting, coining terms such as new journalism, resistance literature, magical realism. That's one of the reasons that in their day, the reviews weren't all good. They still aren't, largely because their journalism defied convention and categorization. But the years since have proven that they would inspire future generations to consider new ways of presenting news stories. We begin with a writer who saw in the world of fiction writing tools that journalists could use, Tom Wolfe.
I have no idea who coined the term the new journalism, or even when it was coined. At the time, the mid-60s, one was aware only that all of a sudden there was some sort of artistic excitement in journalism, and that was a new thing in itself.
It actually started in Esquire magazine, which was the leading men's magazine of the 50s, and they were declining in circulation because they were getting competition from Playboy and these other men's magazines. So they decided that they would have flashy writing. It was commercial in its initial establishment. It was to try to write about things differently than other people had written about them, but also to write about topics that people had not written about.
The new journalism was a style of reported nonfiction. They focused on characterization, scene building, narrative, and it was a journalism that aspired toward greater artistry than journalism had before. Tom Wolfe was working for the Herald Tribune, and he had reported a story about custom-made cars in California, and he ended up pitching the story instead to Esquire magazine.
I was sent up there to cover the Hot Rod and Custom Car Show by the New York Herald Tribune. And I brought back exactly the kind of story the somnambulistic totem newspapers in America would have come up with. A totem newspaper is the kind people don't really buy to read, but just to have, physically, because they know it supports their own outlook on life. The totem story usually makes what is known as gentle fun of this, which is a way of saying, oh, don't worry, these people are nothing.
He couldn't write the piece. It was just a bunch of random paragraphs on the page. And that night, he stayed up all night and wrote a letter to the editor explaining what he wanted the piece to say.
He sent in the letter. The editor, whose name was Byron Doble, just chopped off the Dear Byron and published it as is. In orthodox newspaper reporting, the voice of the reporter had to sound very authoritative.
And here is a special bulletin from the Associated Press.
Tom Wolfe sometimes called it the BBC voice, or this kind of conformist, slightly snobbish, elite person surveying the world around him or her. And at this time, a lot of the barriers around authority were breaking down. People were questioning institutions. They were playing with new cultural ideas. And this stuffy tone was no longer appropriate.
It took a subject that was very pop, that was not an elite subject, that maybe even was something that standard journalism would have made fun of or would have looked down upon, and said that it had a serious political and social meaning. This sounds so stupid now. We all do this, right? But at the time, nobody did it. It was something novelists did. And that was the way the new journalism made journalism fresh again, one of those many times when journalism had remade itself.
And yet in the early 1960s, a curious new notion, just hot enough to inflame the ego, had begun to intrude into the tiny confines of the feature statosphere. This discovery, modest at first, humble, in fact, deferential, you might say, was that it just might be possible to write journalism that would read like a novel.
The times were murkier. There was no longer faith in good and bad. For example, the Vietnam War was happening, and officials were lying to reporters.
I think we would accelerate our progress.
There was no way to tell a story like that straight. You had to foreground your own doubts and your own self-consciousness, your own uncertainty. So a writer like Michael Hare, who wrote a book about the Vietnam War called Dispatches, would go into the field and simply describe some of the scenes he was seeing, but also the confusion that was there. And that was new, to not have to go and be like, this is where we've advanced on the front, this is the number of people that have been killed.
Old line journalists never liked it, you know? It wasn't reliable. It was getting above its place, right? To do this. That's what a novelist did, you know? You're a novelist, you know, suffer in your garret, starve, and write your goddamn novel. But, you know, don't put it in the newspaper.
Most good journalists who hope to get inside someone else's world and stay there a while come on very softly and do not bombard their subjects with questions. If a reporter stays with a person or group long enough, they, the reporter and the subject, will develop a personal relationship of some sort, even if it is hostility. More often, it will be friendship of some sort.
Hunter S. Thompson spent months with the Hell's Angels writing about them, just living with them and writing about them. And the kind of journalism that we have now that's a little bit more restricted by money, by time, by the pace at which things are published on the internet doesn't necessarily lend itself to that kind of immersion.
One of the reasons people believed in new journalism was that it convinced you that you were learning through these narrative techniques something inside other people, that you were using a writer's sensitivity to understand what other people believed and felt.
To really understand people, you have to go out into the world. You have to go away from cosmopolitan centers, into smaller communities, into rural communities, into people who might not be the same class or race or, you know, nationality as you, and try to understand their motivations and their reality.
Saturation reporting, as I think of it, can be one of the most exhilarating trips, as they say, in the world. Often you feel as if you've put your whole central nervous system on red alert and turned it into a receiving set, with your head panning the molten tableau like a radar dish, with you saying, "Come in, world, since you want all of it."
Some voices, rare ones, that can take a moment in time and give it meaning. Voices of clarity that are themselves not easily defined. Hassan Kanafani, a writer, artist, journalist, playwright, and politico, was one of those people.
As surely as the Middle East turmoil keeps away the tourists.
A video from 1970, a news report, captures Kanafani in the city where he made his name.
In Beirut, a new business has developed. Revolution. Palestinian revolution.
He's interviewed by Richard Carlton for Australia's ABC News.
The Beirut leader of the Popular Front is Ghassan Kanafani. He was born in Palestine but fled in 1948, as he puts it, from Zionist terror.
As the English-speaking spokesman of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, Kanafani made good TV, but he was by no means an easy interviewee.
It does seem that the war, the civil war, has been quite fruitless.
It's not a civil war. It's a people defending themselves against a fascist government.
It's a moment of great confidence, of clarity of vision, of conviction. And the way Ghassan Kanafani speaks in that clip shows all of this, this energy that was the hope of the Palestinian revolution.
Well, a conflict.
It's not a conflict. It's a liberation movement fighting for justice.
Well, whatever it might be best called.
It's not whatever.
Kanafani picks up on a very important word, which for me resonated the strongest, and this is the word whatever.
This is exactly where the problem starts. This is a people who is discriminated, is fighting for his rights. This is a story.
And this is the narrative that Palestinians unfortunately have not been able to relay to the world. The Palestinian narrative as narrated by Palestinians is not something that the world wants to hear.
Why not just talk?
Talk to whom?
Talk to the Israeli leaders.
That's kind of conversation between the sword and the neck, you mean?
Ghassan said it in simple and clear language. How are we supposed to have dialogue? You're coming to slaughter me. Put aside the sword so we can have a conversation.
They're better that way than dead, though.
Maybe to you, but to us, it's not. To us, to liberate our country, to have dignity, to have respect, to have our mere human rights, is something as essential as life itself.
In the Arab imagination, Kanafani is remembered for his storytelling, which explored the Palestinian experience, statelessness, separation, and exile. In the West, he was the public face of the leftist PFLP, seen as one of the more radical Palestinian factions. Kanafani was not involved in the armed wing of the PFLP, or in the planning of high-profile airplane hijackings that the group became synonymous with. But he was an advocate of armed struggle and understood its mediatic value. If it went quiet, he wrote, no TV network would willingly give any Palestinian a minute of coverage to express themselves. Above all, though, Kanafani was a journalist, an accomplished one.
Ghassan Kanafani was a multifaceted, multi-talented human being. He was very significant in the Kuwaiti and Lebanese press in their heyday. We're talking about the 1950s and 60s. Ghassan Kanafani was a central figure. I mean, he was associated with the founding of many magazines and newspapers throughout the region.
After the defeat of Arab regimes in the War of 1967 and the disillusionment that came with it, Palestinians took matters into their own hands. A national struggle for liberation took form. And for Kanafani, it marked a shift in thinking to the revolutionary politics of the PFLP. In 1969, he was made editor-in-chief of Al-Hedef, the group's newly formed weekly magazine. Al-Hedef was revolutionary in spirit and substance. It combined the PFLP's political messaging with analysis, humor, art, and calligraphy in a chronicle of the Palestinian resistance that linked it to anti-colonial struggles in Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
He made left-wing media accessible well beyond the narrow confines of the already converted. He went after arguments by fellow Arab journalists as much as he went after arguments by Western journalists. His articles were an unusual combination of satire, sharp witticism, as well as information. I mean, can you imagine Soviet communist literature using humor and irony at that time? There was none of that. And Arab communists were even more dour, more humorless than the Soviet Union. So you can imagine when Ghassan Kanafani comes with this new form of media, it was entirely novel.
Al-Hedef had an open-door policy that made it a hub of cultural and artistic exchange. It was there that Kanafani and his associates produced some of the most iconic posters of the Palestinian Revolution. It was a progressive magazine with an engaged international readership, but it was the official party organ, some would say the mouthpiece, of the PFLP.
I don't like the term mouthpiece. It's not true. Neither was it propaganda. We were not spreading propaganda. We were trying to get the truth to the people. That was the slogan of Al-Hadaf. It read, "The truth is always revolutionary," which is what Lenin wrote. These truths were the refugee camps or the truth of the Palestinian situation. Al-Hadaf was open to accept all kinds of new ideas. And for this reason, I think the importance of literature and journalism and culture from that era is that it was the founding culture.
Kanafani left a distinctive imprint on the Arab cultural and media space. There is his pioneering fictional writing, and then there is this huge body of journalistic work. And when you look at the range of his output, you get the sense perhaps that he knew his time was limited, that he had a target on his back. On the 8th of July, 1972, Kanafani and his niece were killed in a car bomb outside his home. He was 36. It was among the first in a series of Israeli assassinations targeting Palestinian leaders and cultural figures. In its obituary of Kanafani, Lebanon's Daily Star said he was a commando who never fired a gun, whose weapon was a ballpoint pen, and his arena, newspaper pages.
Israel decided to go after all facets of the Palestinian national movement. Whether they were writers, journalists, combatants, they made no distinction whatsoever. They wanted to extinguish the flame of the Palestinian national movement in all its forms. Ghassan Kanafani has gone through two lives. There was the life that he actually lived on this planet, and there was a second life that he has been living after his death, especially in the last 20 years.
His iconic image is almost everywhere. There's so many Facebook pages dedicated to him, Instagram pages. Resistance for him was something that was not necessarily just an action. The heart of resistance could be in the written word, and this voice of hope and aspiration and clarity and conviction we don't have anymore, and that's why this resonates so strongly with us today.
La etiqueta de realismo mágico que se le pone a la obra de García Márquez, la gente suele pensar primero en la fantasía, en lo mágico.
Que la casa estaba llena de mariposas amarillas.
La abuela de una amiga mía cartagenera, que conocía a García Márquez como socialmente, siempre decía, no, es que yo no entiendo por qué a Gavito pues, le dan tantos premios y él no se inventó nada. Todo eso que le ha contado, todo eso pasó.
Gabo le piden el favor de que vaya y haga un reportaje en Chocó, porque hay una información según la cual hay una protesta pública de gente en las calles porque no hay suministros de agua ni servicios públicos y la gente está enfurecida. Y Gabo se va allá y llega al Chocó y empieza a ver, llega a Quibdó, pasan los días, el editor no sabe nada de Gabo, empieza a buscarlo y empieza a buscarlo y le dice, Gabo, finalmente lo encuentra y le dice, ¿qué pasó? Entonces Gabo le dice, mira, la verdad es que yo llegué aquí, ¿sí? Y no hay protesta, no hay ninguna protesta. Ahora, la situación sí está muy grave. ¿Sí? Y entonces, ¿qué hace Gabo? Hace la crónica y la manera como hace la crónica, ¿sí?, produce la protesta, ¿sí?
La hermosa y triste canción compuesta por el maestro de escuela de una remota aldea chocuana.
Yo tuve la fortuna de estar en un taller de periodismo organizado por la Fundación Nuevo Periodismo en México con Rizar Kapuscinski y García Márquez, que fue algo así pues como totalmente soñado. Entramos a discutir esto de que había como unos datos que ellos habían puesto en sus historias que realmente pues no se ajustaban a la realidad. Y para algunos de los periodistas que estábamos en ese taller, y pues que teníamos 25 años o 24 años, nos parecía un poquito escandaloso que ellos hubieran inventado cosas. Pero García Márquez tuvo esta frase que a mí nunca se me olvida, diciendo como, bueno, si uno para contar la verdad tiene que poner una lagrimita de más, pues ¿qué más da?
Salgar le dijo un día, oye Gabo, mira a ver esta cosa, esta noticia que pasó aquí, un señor que duró no sé cuántos días, porque fue unos días, cantidad de días, impresionante, en el mar, un naufragio, murió, no sé qué, sobrevivió él. La noticia había salido por todas partes, porque era una noticia insólita. Gabo la leyó, trabajó el tema y volvió a donde su editor y le dijo, ¿sabes qué? Yo quiero hacer una crónica de este náufrago. Le dijo el editor, pero ya ha salido en todas partes, ya no es la hora. Yo, todo, yo te dije, era el momento, pero ya han pasado como un mes o mes. ¿Para qué? Dijo, no, es que la historia real no la han contado. Gabo se fue, se sentó con este náufrago horas y horas y horas, que decidió cuando llegó otra vez a la redacción del Espectador y le dijo al editor, al Mono Sagrado, le dijo, ¿sabe qué? Terminé esta cosa, pero la quiero hacer en series, una por una. Una serie, dos series, tres series, cuatro series, como las series de Netflix.
Es verde y era como la corteza de un árbol.
Y que empezó a generar una audiencia impresionante. La gente esperaba cada semana el nuevo capítulo de este náufrago. Series como la del náufrago eran realmente unas crónicas periodísticas, casi que literarias, diría yo. Es hermana prima del reportaje, digámoslo así. Pero la crónica tiene color, tiene vida, tiene minuciosas descripciones.
Tuve la sensación de que tenía un sabor fresco y un poco amargo.
Nosotros los latinoamericanos no somos como los anglosajones, que tenemos unas definiciones muy precisas sobre lo que es realmente. Es una historia contada con todos esos aderezos, ¿sí? Y Gabo las sabía contar.
García Márquez alguna vez dijo en una entrevista, con una terquedad enfermiza toda mi vida he soñado con tener un periódico. Fue miembro del grupo de la revista Alternativa y de hecho de su propio dinero financió en gran medida ese proyecto periodístico, pero a partir de los 80 quiere tener un medio propio. Entra, sin embargo, a el noticiero QAP con un grupo de amigos, un noticiero de televisión, y luego, en los años 90, decide establecer una revista y termina comprando la revista Cambio y crea la fundación, el García Márquez de esta segunda etapa de periodismo, en que ya es un periodista independiente, es un García Márquez que no quiere que se invente nada.
Enormes barrios marginales en las ciudades mayores de Chile.
Hay toda una generación también de cronistas, es decir, de narradores periodísticos. Y creo que la fundación ha tenido la capacidad de adaptarse a los cambios del periodismo, de reconocer que el periodismo contemporáneo adquiere muchas formas. A mí lo que más me alegra es pensar que Gabriel García Márquez sigue inspirando más allá de que esté vivo o no.
Yo siento que él se volvió un poco como el verdadero biógrafo de Colombia, mucho más que los historiadores, ¿no? A pesar de que él se estaba inventando como un mundo mágico, él logró explicar como el sustrato y como el imaginario colectivo, ¿no? Entonces siento que en esta época tan confusa, tener a alguien que pudiera narrar a ese nivel y le ayudara a uno a entender más allá de la razón qué es lo que sucede, pues creo que sería muy útil, ¿no? Pero no me imagino él cómo lo haría, pero seguro sería increíble.
These are confusing times, and making sense of it all might be asking a little much. It does make you wonder, though, what García Márquez, Canafani, and Wolf would have made of the fake news phenomenon today, the blending of fact and fiction meant to confuse rather than inform. You've been watching a special edition of our program on journalism from off the beaten track. We'll see you next time here at the Listening Post.